You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Let's get to the games. Leading us in conversation tonight is Sam Roberts, who is the Assistant Director of the Interactive Media Division at USC, and he'll be moderating the conversation between game designers Mark Essen and Tracy Fullerton. And you'll have a moment to ask them. You'll have a moment to ask them questions as well at the end of the conversation, so save your questions and we'll pass a microphone to you at that time. And we do record for podcast and ask that you don't take photos during the program. I'd like to give a special thanks to the folks over at IndieCade who helped provide us with volunteers to run Staccato, which was the name of the ball game in the courtyard. Thank you, and also to the Game Lab at UCLA, and Steven, who's roaming, or maybe he's sitting now, but he had the arcade backpack on that you saw in advance. And the game that you saw here on the screen was called Nidhogg, and you'll hear more about that soon, but that is the creation of Mark Essen. So we're all here tonight because we like to play and we want to better understand how this gaming revolution is taking education, the arts, medicine, and science in entirely new directions. Just days from now in Culver City, the only standalone, independent-focused game festival in the nation begins. It's called IndieCade and has been dubbed the Video Games Industry's Sundance. But aside from festivals, the world around us is constantly trying to engage us in play. And to root this conversation to the library, I wanted to share a quote I heard recently from novelist Juno Diaz, who says he loves to read because books are games, and they ask us to participate in them. So to talk to us about games tonight are Mark Essen, a local game designer who recently graduated with an MFA from UCLA's Design and Media Arts program. His work has been exhibited in Sao Paulo and Berlin, at the New Museum in New York, the MoCA in Toronto, and at Vice Intel's International Creators Project. As someone who grew up playing games, Mark took his love of playing to the next level when he started creating them. He now teaches at USC. Joining Mark in conversation is Tracy Fullerton, an experimental game designer, professor, and director of the Game Innovation Lab at USC's School of Cinematic Arts, where she holds the Electronic Arts Endowed Chair in Interactive Entertainment. The Game Innovation Lab is a design research center that has produced several influential independent games, including The Night Journey, a collaboration with media artist Bill Viola. Tracy is also the author of Game Design Workshop, a play-centric approach to creating innovative games. Leading the conversation for us tonight is Sam Roberts, Assistant Director of the Interactive Media Division at USC. Sam has also organized and directed the IndieCade Festival of Independent Games for the last 5 years. He has been directing, designing, writing, and producing entertainment and events in the creative world for the past 10 years. So please help me give a warm welcome to Sam, to Tracy, and to Mark.
Thank you all very much for coming. So we're going to just dive in here in a moment, but right before we get started, I'd just like to talk real quickly about what games are, maybe get us on a little bit of a common footing here. So who in the audience considers himself someone who plays games? Okay, that's a pretty good number, actually. when I say games, I'm not just talking about digital experiences, which I think is what the term has come to mean a lot of times in modern culture. This isn't just computer games or iPhone games or Nintendo games. Who in this audience plays poker? Who plays Hearts or Pinochle with their family? Who plays Candyland or Risk or board games like that? Okay, so this is all of you, and this is my point. Checkers. Checker? Who plays checkers or chess or Go? Everyone in this room probably plays at least one game. And for me, and usually when I'm talking to game designers, I think we like to think of games as being all of those experiences together. So though we'll talk about, actually, several digital projects, we will talk about some non-digital stuff. And when we're talking about games, we mean sort of games in general. So as we go along the ride, just keep your minds open to that. So let's sort of get started. So Tracy and Mark, one of the things that really drives my interest in games that I think makes for compelling, interesting games in the modern day is the idea that games are a way to express yourself. Just like media forms and art forms that we've been encountering as human beings for centuries, you may have something deep and personal you want to say or express. You might have some goal you're trying to achieve in the world. And in our modern age, many people are driven to express that or put that on the world by creating games and creating interactive experiences that are, again, both digital and physical. Millions of artists who have come before have told us why they make art, but I would like to know why you make games.
You're asking me first? Or
go for it.
I'm going to let you guys jump in.
Okay, we'll do a little rush on Bill. For me, I mean, it's a way of understanding the world. Right, so when you start to make a game, you're really building a system, and that system is an abstraction, usually of some thing that happens in the world. Even if it's so very abstracted, it's no longer recognizable. You know, for example, it might be an abstraction of combat. It might be, to think of some of the games that I've made, an abstraction of something like the spiritual journey. Right. Right now, I'm working on a game about Thoreau's stay at Walden Pond and the experiment in living that he conducted there. And so, really, I'm driven by a curiosity about that. How does that work? What parts of that sort of interoperate, and how can I play with them? And so, it's the games are the best medium for engaging with the questions that I have about the world.
And Mark, is that similar to why you make games, or does your passion come from a different place?
Well, I think I'm mostly, I enjoy making games, just the thrill of writing code and then playing it and iterating on design. And for a long time, I thought I wanted to make films. I went to film school. Well, if I back up, I had a video camera for a birthday in high school. And, you know, that was the first time I was able to create my own stories and my own movies. And it was a tool I could use to, you know, create this, create a video by myself about a variety of different things. I could also do animation on the computer. I went to film school, took a lot of classes in filmmaking and screenwriting and stuff like that. But then I discovered GameMaker, which is this game engine which allows one person to create a game all on their own. So I started coding. I taught myself to code and taught myself how to do all the different aspects of making a game, and just got kind of addicted to that. I whenever I make a game, I never really know what I'm doing to start with, so I don't feel like I have a goal that I'm trying to express necessarily.
But you do feel sort of driven to do it.
So. Yeah, it's fun, and I just love making games.
touching on a little bit of what Tracy said, do you feel like you are a systemic thinker? Is that what drove you to games as a way to express yourself? Or do you find that you don't engage with games that way, that you don't think about them as interlocking systems that you are using to explore the world?
I do. I think you have to. So when I say iterative design, it means I put a couple things together, see how they work, and then you know, if something doesn't work, take it out, change it. So I'm teaching a class with Peter right now, and his the example he always uses is if you're baking something or you're cooking something, you don't really, maybe you just have a fridge full of random ingredients. You don't really know where you're going, but you know you like butter. So you put butter in a bowl and you taste it, and it tastes good, it tastes like butter. It's a little too simple. So you might add like sugar to it. Does it still taste good? It tastes pretty good. And then, maybe you add like coffee grounds, and that might have been a mistake. Because it tastes bad at first, but maybe coffee grounds are intrinsic to the goal you're trying to get to. Maybe you want it to taste a little bitter, and you'll later balance it out with other ingredients. So there's plenty of examples of that. Like,
so it's a process of slowly assembling those different pieces and seeing how they fit together and how they work together and what are the right steps and what are the wrong.
Yeah, which is definitely a systemic way of looking at it rather than narrative.
Tracy. Do you find that in your cooking process, that butter and those eggs and those sugar, that each one of those is a system that you're using to examine a different part of the game, or are they fitting together inside a system that's what you're really trying to explore?
Well, I'm not sure. We use a lot of butter in the game lab. I think that every game is different, and I tend to proceed from... first, kind of trying to identify the actual user experience that I want to have, that I want to, it's usually me, I want to play the game, right? But then, you know, also a wider audience. What is that experience? And then work my way through the problems that that presents sort of step by step. So I think that I agree with Mark's cooking analysis. I think that a lot of times when people make games in maybe the commercial space, they start with a really tried and true recipe and then tweak from there. And
so
I like
chocolate chip cookies with cranberries in it.
Yeah, just adding one little new feature. And I think that what's kind of great about being in the environments that we work in is that there's much more freedom. So you can just start with the butter if you want to, or
right. Start with a coffee.
Whatever. I mean, we're sort of beating this analogy to death now, but maybe we're gonna whip it into something. Yeah. Who knows? But I think that's sort of the freedom of what we call experimental game design, or what some people say art games, where you can just start with surprising, impertinent, strange ingredients, mechanics, and ideas. And throw them all in the game and see what happens.
Mark, is that very similar for you? Is that why you make personal games and you aren't trying to work at a large company or work on a console title, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call them personal games. They're just the way Tracy and I think work. I think the similarity is that we're both on small teams. I'm one person. The game lab it's not a huge
group. It's pretty small.
Smaller than most games you would play on, like, a console, for instance. So I think we take the approach of making things one at a time rather than making, like in Call of Duty, you might be on the multiplayer team, or you're on this team, or you're on that team, and they come together in the end. But there's a long gap between when, you know, all these different elements before they come together. Whereas with us, I think we make things...
A little more holistically.
A little at a time, holistically, yeah. So
maybe a little more intuitively, too, because you're not answering to a bottom line. You're not answering to someone, a company that maybe owns a franchise or needs a franchise to fill a certain slot in their, offerings. So we have a freedom in exploration that way.
Yeah, you try not to make any promises you can't keep.
Okay. Would you tell me about something you're working on right now in that vein?
This game, if you had a chance to play it beforehand, it's called Nidhogg. It's fencing. It's a fighting game, sort of like Street Fighter, but the theme is fencing, which is pretty rare, I think, in games. And the ultimate goal is to get to the opponent's side, sort of like a soccer match. You're hitting the ball back and forth, but instead of a ball, you're killing each other repeatedly with swords. That's it's still in development. It's playable now, but there's lots of things I want to add. there's ingredients I spy on the shelf.
Like what?
Well, like maybe a battle axe that's more gesture-based rather than height-based. Like in this game, you press up and down to change your sword height, but I'm thinking about playing that off of a different weapon that would be gesture-based, for like, you know, your swinging the joystick in a certain way would have a different action in the game. And I don't know. I mean, different. There's all sorts of other level design issues or level design choices I can make with new levels.
Let's take just a quick second. I want to make sure everyone in the audience actually can keep up with this. So when we say level design choices, what are you talking about specifically?
I'm talking about, well, the game takes place in a castle, a virtual castle full of different pits and spikes and what have you. But the arrangement of those elements decides what kind of strategies players can take. For instance, if there's a big pit and one guy is on this side of the pit and you're on the other side of the pit, you can either wait for him to get out of the way so you can jump over the pit, or you can just try jumping over and kicking him in the head, faking him out and throwing your sword in his face. I mean, there's different...
So by the way you lay out the design of sort of the architecture of the level, you're enabling or turning off options for the player, essentially.
Yeah, so if there's, you know, if there's a pit, that's one thing. If there's a spikes above it, maybe you, that limits your motions in different ways. Yeah.
anyway. Well, and so when you talk about adding elements, I know I don't want to go back to the same metaphor, but what you mean is that you have a functioning game, and it's got a couple, it's got a core system, you have a level design, the things are there, and now you want to see how that changes as you add stuff.
Right.
Where are you looking for that change? Is you looking in the player? When you talk about iterative design, do you change and then test with the player and watch, or are you talking about a different process? Where's your test for what has happened once you add an element or ingredient?
Well, one example is it used to be a more straightforward sword fighting game where you could walk around and stab each other. Then I added a sword throwing move. So one of the major problems after lots of playtests with that was that people would run past the opponent instead of killing him. And they would just keep running and you could never catch up. So high-level players would just run the opposite direction if they were behind and you know kill themselves to respawn in front. So to counteract that, I wanted to add in a sword throwing move to close the distance. So if you were behind, you could throw your sword. The sword could catch up and maybe give you the upper hand. But you know the problem with that was that people would just throw their swords all the time. It was overpowered in a close range because you couldn't anticipate where it would hit you. Like normally your sword is already at the right height or at a set height and you can say, oh, he's at the high level. I have to move up to the high level to block him. But if I'm throwing you my sword, it's too quick to react. So that was a design choice, I guess. And, the choice was, do I keep in the throws? Are the throws a good idea intrinsically? Or is there, because they have lots of problems to band-aid, or is there a better solution? And I kept the throws, and the solution that I came up with was to, you know, the problem was anticipation. You couldn't anticipate the throws, so I added in animations to wind up the throw. I added in other moves like ducking to duck under to give you different options of dodging or blocking.
So you sort of saw where the results of the one change occurred and then looked to other parts of the game or other systems in the game where you could counteract the negative while keeping the positive.
Right, yeah. So just, yeah, playtesting is definitely like the main driving force of this game because I want it to be a competitive game. So,
I'm really interested in talking about competitive. We're going to come back to that in a minute. I'd love to ask Tracy about a recent project she's worked on.
Right, so it's completely different from ARCS. I mean, it couldn't be more different.
Different.
So I brought a little, some stuff here, which hopefully, if the gods of technology are with us, we will be able to see. How are we doing? All right. Just very quickly, this is an experimental game that may or may not have been played at the School of Cinematic Arts last fall. And the School of Cinematic Arts is a kind of old, it's the oldest film school in the nation, and has a kind of a culture that, while creative, may not have the same energy that it's had in the past. And so trying to break through that, we decided to create this experience that invited incoming freshmen in the school to sort of find a secret world behind the facade of the normal everyday operations of the school. So when they first came to school, there was this strange flag flying in the courtyard. And they started talking about it in their Facebook group. And then we saw them talking about it, so we sent those people who were talking about it a special message that said, what to do when you see the flag, right? There was a series of puzzles that led them to a room, the game office, where there was a bunch of grad students who were sitting around, and they claimed to be in the employ of this mysterious committee called the Reality Committee. And the Reality Committee was this committee who was created this experience, and they gave them a packet of cards, and they told them to they asked them to swear an oath of DIY media, which was to be both fearless in their creativity and safe in themselves. And the cards were a sort of wide variety of cards with media figures on them on one side. And on the other side were a series of prompts. So on the back of Mary Pickford would be something like the silent short, make a silent short. On the back of this stunt, which was a famous stunt in the school's history where somebody put a biplane in the courtyard, there was actually in the SCA courtyard. And if you put these things together, you could make what was called a deal. And a deal was worth a certain amount of points, depending on how many cards there were in it. So if you started adding more cards, it would be worth more points. Actually, if you started adding what are called orange cards, it was worth quite a lot of points. Those were other people who you had to find and interact with. Deals were made by groups of players. So here's a picture of some players who got together to make a deal, and everyone who participated would actually get all the points that are on all the cards in the deal. So while deals started out small, like this one, they very quickly got to be very large, like this one. And the deals really just were creative prompts. They were sort of procedurally created prompts. But what they did was they sent players all over the school to create media and then post it up on a website where they could share it with their peers. And where it could be evaluated by the Reality Committee. And very quickly, a sort of productive chaos or tribalism formed where there were groups of students who were working together to create these mega deals, right? They signed contracts with each other, exclusivity contracts, right? And I have a very short video here just showing the passion of the students.
They said it was just a game. We were supposed to collaborate, become friends. Boy, were they wrong.
Why do they call you the master of the game?
It's kind of a long story.
Good luck.
What's the number of Mara doing here anyways?
I'm looking for someone named Amber. I thought I could find her here. Do you know her?
You're looking at her.
At first, she was just another orange card. Someone else to use. But then, something changed.
There are only two winners this week.
See white glasses and you'll walk away.
Told the tribe I was at your party?
I never said anything. Why are you blaming me?
Because you're the only one who knows I was there.
A deal's a deal.
I made a few enemies. You don't understand. It was the only way to win.
But at what cost, Carver? What have you done?
You're a little bit self-aware.
You keep this up, I'm taking this to Sam.
So, just very quickly, the passion that you see there is driven by the fact that as students uploaded their deals to the website, and they were seen by the community and judged by the community. The reality committee was also watching, and the reality committee would select students every week to, they would send them a mysterious email to meet, say, on a street corner, where they'd be taken, they'd be picked up by a car with the game logo and taken to meet famous media folks, like here's John Singleton meeting with a group of students, or Dante Spinotti, who's a cinematographer. He did most of Michael Mann's films. And they would sit and talk with them and have lunch with them, or brainstorm with them, or do just very one-on-one sort of individual meetings that were super inspiration to the students. And the message really was, start your lives now. Right, and it's the irony is, of course, the title of the game is "Reality Ends Here," when really what we're saying is it starts here. And I really should credit also Jeff Watson, the creative director and lead designer, and Simon Wiscombe, co-designer with myself, and Anna Lotko, the lead game runner. This game is now running, or perhaps I should say, maybe running again with the freshman class that has just come in. It's become sort of a part of the a sort of fictional history of the school, if you will. And we hope to see it kind of evolve and grow as time goes on.
Thank you, Tracy. So to jump back into our conversation, where we left off with Mark was competition. And before I go there, I would like to ask you, specifically, it seems like the mechanic here, the deal-making, when I say mechanic, I mean the central interaction of the game. I will use the word a lot, and I want to make sure I define it. So in a platformer like Super Mario Brothers, the mechanic is jumping and running. In a game like Reality, the mechanic is making those deals with the cards.
Right.
So that mechanic is an inherently social mechanic.
That's right.
Was a social design part of the front-end goal of making this game?
Absolutely. So when you come to college, as you know, many of us know, you know, you're thrown into this new world, and you know, a lot of times you're far away from home. You're usually in these huge classrooms, right? And you're in your general education their first couple of years, and a lot of times students come with this amazing energy, but then that fades away as they learn to be college students, as they learn to sort of, you know, sit and take notes in these huge lecture halls. And what we wanted to do was activate that inherent energy that they come to school with and say, hey, you know, there's a whole bunch of other people here who want to make media with you right now, who don't want to sit around and you know, wait for your GEs to be over so it's time for you to make your films. Just start today. And so the idea of building a rapport, building a social network, learning what are called 21st century skills, and really doing it in a way that was almost invisible to the students, it just turned the switch and motivated them to do what they already knew how and wanted to do. Those were kind of the high level goals.
Okay, and Mark, when we last talked to you, you mentioned that you had always wanted the game to be competitive. So was that a design goal going in? And do you consider competition a social interaction? Have you seen it create social situations? I mean, I know you've run tournaments of the game in social situations.
Sure, yeah. My girlfriend Christy and I threw a party a couple years ago where it was just the whole theme of the party was this tournament of Nidhogg. So it was loosely, it was hard to keep track of everyone, but we tried to have a ladder system and go down. I think it was double elimination over the, yeah. But yeah, that's what I'm really interested in. I have, you know, it's not just Nidhogg. I have another game called Tickle Plane, where it's a six-player game where you're controlling airplanes on a big big blue sky. Each player has their own keyboard, and every key on the keyboard controls the plane in a different way. So, for instance, if you bash on the right side of the keyboard, your plane goes to the right. The left side goes to the left. As you shoot other players, they have to type out words to repair their plane. But yeah, I mean, the idea was to, I was really obsessed with StarCraft for a while. I don't know if anyone's played StarCraft. it's practically,
why don't you, yeah, explain StarCraft.
It's sort of, it's a video game, but it's sort of a national sport in Korea. like it's televised and everything. I guess, yeah, so esports is the new revolution in competitive video games. It's televised, organized sports, much like, you know, the football game going on right now. And yeah, so in, you know, in Korea, there are professional StarCraft players that are sponsored, and some of their metrics are different than football metrics. They don't talk about wins, losses, like passes and, sorry, whatever.
It's okay,
they, you know, they talk about APM, which is actions per minute, how many, you know, actions you can perform per minute with a mouse and keyboard, how many shortcuts you can, you know, fire off to control or to micromanage your army, army of hundreds of characters.
Which is how StarCraft works. It's a strategy game where you deploy lots of different units to achieve goals.
Right.
Is that what you have in mind when you're building for competition? Or do you have a different kind of social template in mind?
Well, one goal was to create a spectacle, much like the StarCraft professional world. So if you watch a StarCraft game and you don't actually watch the game, you just watch the players, it looks like they're just bashing on the keyboard, you know, sort of randomly. They use these professional gamer keyboards that are sort of like keyboards you would see in the 80s, mechanical keyboards. Every key has a different switch, so every key makes a different noise. They're really loud. So I just wanted to recreate that, but also make a game like Nidhogg that's easy to just pick up and play. So, those are the goals, just have six people bashing on keyboards.
But so you wanted to create something that was socially engaged, competitive, but created sort of a beautiful spectacle to watch.
Right.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Sure. Well, okay. A spectacle.
Right.
I guess what I'm sort of trying to get at from both of you here is we talked earlier about why you make games. And Tracy, you make games to explore the way parts of the world work. And Mark, you make games because you're just sort of driven to experiment with play. But I think it is very interesting, and I think it is a one of the things that I have been personally noticing as experimental game design and independent game design move forward is there's been a strong push towards what I would call social game design. When I say social, you will hear, and for the past few years, those of you particularly who know a little bit about the game space have been hearing about social games. That phrase tends to mean actually games you play on Facebook, games that are played by interacting with your groups of friends digitally online. But when I say I see a push towards social game design, what I'm talking about is games like Reality and games like Tickleplane, games that are activating small groups of people to find expertise or spectacle or beauty or a DIY creation aesthetic amongst themselves. And I'm interested in how both of you sort of approach the mechanics and levers inside your games to try to provoke that experience. I know on the front end, as both the questions I asked you sort of show, obviously Reality has to be social because you have to make a deal, and obviously Nidhogg and Tickleplane are social because you have to play with another person. But what are you doing at a deeper design level to provoke that social experience? And why do you think you're driven to social experiences? Is it just the games that you love, or is there something else that's I don't know what word I wanted. Why don't you answer my question?
You want to go first?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I think the arcades are gone, so that social interaction is not really here anymore. I think my generation missed out on most of it. So a lot of us that are making games now in our 20s and 30s are trying to imagine what that might have been like to go to the arcades and, you know, mm-hmm. sit down with a game you never played before and just, you know, join this community of pro players or like, you know, high-level players. Like walking by a coffee shop, seeing people play chess, and then just sitting down one day and mm-hmm. getting to know, yeah. But,
Before I let Tracy answer, one thing that I think is very interesting is actually just what you said, that starting in the late 70s or early 80s, games became solo experiences for a while, that you played alone, often in your house.
Right.
Certainly for our generation, there were some two-player competitive or cooperative games that you played on a couch with friends, but generally these were solo experiences that you didn't engage with other people while doing. But before that, just as we have talked about here, games were poker and bridge and chess and Go, and all of these are inherently multiple-player games. None of them are one person against a system except perhaps solitaire. Do you think it's that drives you? Do you think it's the idea that just what you said, that you missed out? I think it was interesting that you said that you missed out. Did you come to a point after playing games where you felt like you were missing something fundamental about what a game was? Or is it just that you felt a little cheated by not getting to go to arcades and beat up on your buddies?
Yeah, I mean, it's partly that I missed out, and I'm imagining how great it was. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also, you know, times have changed, tools have changed. It's sort of like, I don't know, it's like when the first video camera came out and you could finally make your own movies for cheap. Anyone could point a camera and press record. So you didn't have to be a Sega and you didn't have to like produce an arcade cabinet. I can, you know, create this thing. Well, my friend Peter made this, but one could create their own controllers, create their own game, run it on consumer hardware. I mean, that's just what's nice about making games these days. So, yeah, I think that's probably the main reason for me why these games are happening now. It's because we've always liked these games. We've always played games like, you know, played multiplayer games. Gaming is, it's always been a social thing.
Yeah, so, in essence, you sort of think the economic model of console gaming crushed social play for 20 or 30 years, and now that we have other ways to make and engage the culture with games, that we can go back to the way we've always played?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that all games are going to be social games or multiplayer games, but I think that avenue is opened up again where it was closed, I think, or it was drowned out, maybe.
Tracy?
So I didn't miss out. I'm older than these guys. And it was great. Yeah. I just want to tell you. No, there was something so magical about it, right? I remember like the first time there was an arcade machine in the local bowling alley. And, I mean, it changed everything, you know? And then going to the arcade in the summer, I just remember roller skating and roller skating from machine to machine, and it was like this amazing time. So it was great. You should try and recreate it. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I started my career out actually making multiplayer game experiences in the early 90s. First in theaters, where groups of people would actually interact together against a single game experience. And then later, as it became possible online, where actually thousands, sometimes more, people could actually play together in smaller groups, but play together in tournaments and things like that. So that was always something that was super interesting to me, was multiplayer games. More recently, I've been making some single-player games and exploring that space. And I think that, you know, they both have their beauties, right? There's something really wonderful about a single-player experience than you talk about with your friends. Well, I did this and you did that, and that. I think there's an inherent beauty in you know, multiple forms of engagement with games. One of the things I will say is that I agree with you. You know, there's this small period of time where we only had single-player games with engagement technology was sort of an aberration, and it really is changing, I think, because the technology is allowing it, and because it's a natural human
desire
to engage with others. I mean, one of the core strengths of a game, if you really look at how games infiltrate cultures historically, is that they teach us how to act in a small, just society, a little society where we agree to adhere to rules together and to, you know, sort of adjudicate that experience together. And holding those rules in our heads and in our sort of our minds as we play fairly with one another or not, as the case may be, that's a practice that helps us be human. Right, it's a thing that helps us. I remember when my niece and nephew were learning to play games, and they would try to cheat one more space on like, you know, all children's games.
You roll
like,
a five. Yeah, and then they're like on Candyland.
You know, see what I would say, right? And there's something kind of interesting about learning, for example, to take turns, about learning that it's okay to lose, that it's okay to win, and how to win. And, you know, there's all these wonderful things that we learn through games.
What do you, I want to get back to what the rest of you are going to say, but to connect to what you were talking about earlier, you talked about using the design of games and the exploration of the systems as a way to explore the world around you and learn things about that. Do you think that the systems that go into a game and the way they represent things in the world, they are really sort of experimental play spaces? They let you go in and test that system?
Yeah, push on its edges and you know, see how far you can get. And I mean, what's interesting, this game that we may or may not be running this fall has a different tone than the game that we may or may not have run last fall, where the new students who are getting strategy tips from the sophomores, and they're pushing the boundaries a lot harder. I'm just completely fascinated by it because last year they were arguing about whether or not there should be teams, and this year there's teams, and that's it, because everyone knows that's the best strategy. And now it's just about, okay, well, how far can we push before the reality committee pushes back? And you know, like they did something last week which wasn't in the spirit of good play, and so we concocted this way for the reality committee to nicely but very firmly come back and say, okay, this is not in the spirit of good play, you know. And so the reality committee plays this almost you know, parental role in this game, and it's interesting because we don't want to inhibit play, but we want to make sure that there's this sense that we're all playing well together.
That, you know, you're establishing boundaries, which you use to actually make sure you're teaching the lessons you want to teach.
Exactly, and the lessons that we want to teach obviously are self-motivation, just getting, you know, taking initiative and meeting and working with others, and you know, this kind of go-get-o-ness, you know, like just go get it, you know.
So a question I want to ask Mark first, but I'd love to hear what you have to say as well, is, so reality is a game that, and you probably caught this when Tracy was talking about it, but it's a game that has a game runner. So Tracy and the designers are actively involved while the game is happening, and they're able to step in and say, you just did something that you shouldn't do, and as the judge, I'm going to push back so that you learn that there is a boundary there. It's like a referee in a football or basketball game. Digital games are entirely refereed by their systems, by the code that you've written into the game, whether or not they're single or multiplayer. So, Mark, how do you police that boundary in a game like Nidhogg, where you're not there to say, oh, no, you're not supposed to play that way? And I think you maybe touched on this earlier when you were talking about the sword throwing, but...
Yeah, I think you can look to a lot of examples in video games as well as in sports, like in football, for instance. You know, for a long time you couldn't pass the ball. That wasn't an accepted rule. But people would do it, even though it was against the rules, really. But you just wouldn't get caught, right?
Well, no, it wasn't against the rules. It was...
The forward pass.
The forward pass was against the rules. That's correct. Yeah.
but, you know, people did it enough, you know, broke the rules... got away with it, became sort of quasi-legit, and then eventually it was written in, right?
Right. They pushed back and said, oh, okay, well, let's make this a part of the rules because it's more interesting.
Because, you know, it's great. It's a
makes
good
makes the game better, right?
Yeah. Exactly. The forward pass is what makes football exciting.
Yeah. But then the other side of it is game balancing, which is, if you follow StarCraft at all, they're constantly changing the rules of the game for whatever reason, maybe because... People end up only building one type of unit. They only train Marines. They only build the walking robot because that unit is like the best unit as of this patch because it has X and Y. And if you do this thing at this time, you'll always win. But then, you know, when they see these spikes of people always winning with the same strategy, they try to balance, like smooth out the playing field and make that less attractive by, what's it called? Nerfing.
Mm-hmm. Nerfing is the term.
Yeah, nerfing versus buffing. Yeah, so nerfing the values of whatever attack. So just to force people to find other ways to win.
But
so what you're saying is that for a digital game, it's almost the same process, but rather than being an active referee who's involved in every play, you're a referee who watches sort of the agglomeration of many plays and then says, oh, the game isn't running the way we want, so now we'll tweak the rules so it runs a little better, just the way that the NFL Rules Committee meets every year.
Right, which is, it's interesting in digital games because you have such authorship, it seems weird that you're doing that, that you're changing the game after it's released, where, like, it's not like a referee is screwing up, it's the game's always refereed perfectly. That's just, you're changing the actual rules of the game.
You're changing the referee. Would you, and I don't know if this is comes up a lot, but what would you say to someone who says that that's inherently unfair? That you have made a version and they have mastered it, and now you've taken away their mastery by changing the rules.
Yeah, no, I kind of agree. Like, if you follow certain StarCraft players, they'll come up with these beautiful strategies that, you know, depend on very particular rules, and then the rules change, and they're suddenly out of a job, and some other kid that starts where those rules changed, he comes up with a new strategy. And it seems like, in some ways, there's never any evolution of high-level play. Like, you never get to see really great players like you would in maybe baseball, where the rules don't change as quickly. That's the other thing. Like, in digital games, rules can change, like, from day to day.
And do you think... I think what you're saying, and which I think is interesting, is that when the rules are in flux like that, it takes away the capacity for mastery from individual players.
Right. Game designers want mastery, but they're, you know, I think sometimes we're too fickle. We think we see a problem and we fix it through code instead of letting... Because Street Fighter is a great example of a game that's never updated. Like, Street Fighter number 3 came out in arcades, came out on consoles, but there's no ability to update it. They weren't connected over the internet, so... there would be game-breaking combos people would come up with, and it's just impossible to counter them. And so, you know, a game designer now would say, oh, I'll just change that so you can't do that anymore. But over the years, the players would just learn how to spot that coming and just avoid it. It's nothing you could... There's no logical way to spot it coming, but if you can anticipate it, it just becomes another...
If you attain a certain level of mastery, then it becomes...
Then it's just another thing that they could, you know, instead of rock, paper, scissors, maybe there's something else they could throw, and as long as you know that there's a possibility, you can react to it.
It sort of rebalances the space without authorial or referee interference.
Right. I mean, games naturally do that.
I think players will do that. I think that's the beauty of player communities, right? So, I used to play a lot of... Warcraft 2, and sort of the higher level of the characters of Warcraft 2, there's sort of two groups of characters. Like, if you think about a chessboard, right? And the humans versus the orcs in this case. But sort of the highest level of characters, there was an imbalance. So the orcs had a more powerful character at the highest level than the humans did. So either you didn't play humans, or you basically, as a community, you said, okay, well, we're just going to leave those characters out, right? It's bloodlust was on one side, and healing was on the human side, and we just say, we're not playing with bloodlust, right? That's just not happening.
Take it out, so
just take it out, and it's sort of what I find so fascinating is that the flaw itself created an interesting moment of meta play, right? So play above the game, where we had to sit down and say, okay, let's play it, but let's play it this way. And I actually enjoy that. I like the flaw, and I like the negotiation of how we're going to play.
Yeah, I actually love players who build systems on top of pre-existing games to add challenge or fairness. I can go down.
Well, who doesn't? I mean, Monopoly. I mean, for just as an example, who doesn't have house rules for Monopoly, right? Because the game is broken, right? It will go on forever, right? So everybody's kind of put their own little like ingredients, to go back to the earlier metaphor, into Monopoly in order to play it the way that their family in particular likes to play it.
Right. Yeah. No.
sort of a last topic I'd like to get here. So we're talking here about how games can inspire and sort of create social space. And we talked about how that's in contrast to what was a recent aberration, but a fairly long one, where games were in some ways very single-player focused. And we've also talked about sort of using games to express yourself, to explore the world around you. So what is it that you think games can or are contributing actively to society right now. I know you, Tracy, talked about how we use play in games to learn, and I know I've asked both you why you make games, and we haven't talked much about making games that are inspired necessarily to affect the world around you, but they're everywhere right now. And the fashion in big internet businesses is to gamify websites and experiences so that everything becomes, whether or not actually a game, has sort of the trappings of a game put in on top of it. Do you think that this is interesting? Do you think it's something we're going to move away from? Do you think that the sort of spread and impact of games on society is changing? Because as, and I promise I'll stop asking the question in a minute.
I'm in so much pain over the question that you're asking.
The last thing I just was, as we said before, like games have been here for 2,000 years and deeply impactful on society in that fashion. Longer, I apologize, Tracy. So how is the way we interact with them and the way they're impacting us now changing, if at all?
Can I just answer the gamification question?
Yes.
Because it's just caused me so much pain. I think that this notion of gamification, which in short is essentially this idea that we should put points and badges on everything that we do, carries with it a deep misunderstanding about what's compelling about playing a game, right? I mean, the points and the badges are not why people play games. And just by putting points and badges on everyday systems, that doesn't make them more compelling. That doesn't lure us into the experience. It doesn't challenge us. It's not gamification. It's just a layer of complexity on top of everyday affairs. So if I give you points for taking out the trash, you know, that doesn't make taking out the trash any more interesting, right? But there could be, I suppose, maybe there's a taking out the trash game. I don't know. I haven't quite found it. But I suppose there you could find everyday activities that you could work into true game mechanics that had true challenges associated with them.
Mark.
Yeah, gamifying life to. Yeah, that's. I mean, that's not really interesting to me, but. But I do think Facebook games have a potential in that. They're primarily asynchronous games. Mm-hmm. And I love that idea of like play by mail or, mm-hmm. Coming home and like I played Diplomacy. Remotely, a lot. if you have never played it, it's sort of like Risk.
Meet Survivor.
Yeah, it's like a game of world domination where everyone has the same amount of units. So it's about diplomacy. You can't win a battle on your own. You have to convince your friends to help you out. But then all the moves are played in secret, so you can,
Much of the game
is betrayal and forming alliances and then betraying them.
But so what I think you're both saying and what I think is the sort of interesting and compelling answer here is that gamification, as it is being presented and talked about now, is this idea of sort of plugging rewards into daily life and assuming that those rewards will compel people into experiences. And that what you both actually like is taking normal experiences and giving them methods to be explored or played with, opening up a space to have extended discussion through asynchronous play so that you can think about and consider the move, maybe see what several moves might do, or finding game systems that are working on top of other things that allow for exploration. Is that an accurate way of rephrasing what you're saying? And if so, do you think that's possible, and what might it do?
Well, let me make an analogy, okay? So if you asked a kind of a person engaged in what I would call typical gamification to design a tool to open cans, mm-hmm. It would probably look a lot like a can opener because they're looking for something efficient and something that does, extends human capability. So we don't have sharp fingernails. So we need something sharp and something that gives us the mechanical advantage to open the can. Okay? So that's a tool that allows us to do something, and it's a kind of functional thing, right? And badges and points to me are this kind of functional state marker of what you've done, right? if you as a game designer designed something to open cans with, it might look a little bit more like Edward Scissorhands. So, like, you guys remember that? Mm-hmm. Edward Scissorhands, right? So it'd be sort of challenging and funny and compelling to try to open the can with your Edward Scissorhands cans, right? You'd be like, oh, I don't know. Can I do it? Oh, maybe if we go like this, you know? And so a game designer looks for ways to challenge humans, to say, oh, let's not extend your capabilities and make it easy for you. Let's make it hard for you in a way that gives you the chance to be clever, right? And so that's what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in, you know, just, like I say, just kind of operationalizing motivation in this very simplistic way. I want to find ways to challenge humans to be more than they usually are.
Yeah, and I like... And I like these weird Facebook games that maybe purport to be a solution to your to-do list or whatever, but really just invade your life in a sick way. Like, diplomacy is, maybe that doesn't accomplish the same thing, but diplomacy is great because you're not playing the game more than 5 minutes a day, but you're always playing the game. And anytime you talk to any of your friends that are playing the game, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, am I...
Are they trying to...
Yeah, is this part of the game? They're trying to get close to me.
So they blur the line, and they make you look at situations that you might not treat with care and attention or exploration or cleverness. They make you bring those things forward. Into
yeah, they're
like
they're a filter on your world.
Mm-hmm. And, that's awesome. I want to thank you both very much. We're going to take questions from the audience now. So I think we'll just raise hands, and I will call on you, and they will bring you a microphone.
Hi. I was interested because you both explore indie games, and you've got IndieCade coming up, and yet you are the direct beneficiary of a $7.5 million grant from the biggest, or what used to be the biggest, video game company in the universe, EA.
In the universe.
So I'm just curious, as you all continue to work in the beautiful cloistered ivory tower of academia making wonderful, cool games, what your take is on the economics of the business now as you send those students out into the world after they survive the reality committee and just get to meet the reality. So,
sure. That's a great question. So first and foremost, Electronic Arts came in very, very early in the development of our program at USC and not only gave us money, but gave us expertise, they gave us counseling. They helped us to build the curriculum around games. And I think that, you know, for that, they deserve to be lauded, you know, because seeing how games might become a part of the academic culture and how they might be in the same way that other forms of media have become part of academic worlds, I think that was really farsighted of them. So yes, we were totally the beneficiaries of that. But what's interesting is, you know, so they had their business in one place. You know, they basically were sort of, at the time they gave the gift, you know, the game industry felt like a monolith. You know, there's the console games, yeah, okay, PCs, but mostly the console games. And since that time, everything has changed. And the beauty of it is that you need more game designers now because the game design spectrum has disintegrated. It's now not just console games, right? Now it's mobile games and Facebook games and these kind of weird ARG experiences that are some half in the virtual world and half in the real world, and they're all new mechanics. So what you need is people who have flexible design skills who can come up with these new mechanics, who can look at how users or players might interact with them and define that space and then design it and iterate on it. And so what's fascinating is, in a way, Electronic Arts and the the folks who contributed to our program over the years, and also all the other programs that have come about over the years. In a way, they sort of, it's almost like they knew that the industry was going to need all these young thinkers who could reinvent the industry. And so, you know, it's fascinating because they come to find our students, they come to our demo days, and they come to our, you know, our thesis shows, and they're looking for these minds. And I'm sure it's the same at UCLA, and of course we've kind of captured Mark now, so it's kind of half in UCLA and half at USC, which is cool.
Games is the only environment where that will be said. It's cool to be half USC, half UCLA.
I think it's pretty neat.
But yeah, graduates of USC are like, you know, they're in a good spot. There have been a lot of success stories. It's not they learn a thing or two.
They learn a thing or two, yeah. And and we try to help them bridge that gap. So a lot of our students will walk out with advanced game projects that they're prepared to take investment in or to sell that IP to a company. And so we really try to help them bridge that gap. It's also a pretty small program, I mean, relatively.
So there was a question over here and then over here, or either order, it doesn't matter.
Hi, everyone. I'm really interested in games that sort of help us improve work systems. Specifically, Foldit, I think, is one of my favorite examples. And for anybody who's not familiar, Foldit was this great game that was created at the University of Washington, and everyone started playing it, and the game was to design these advanced proteins. And what they came up with was, once you started playing the game, you could kind of intuitively start to make these proteins that were more stable. And they actually, the players solved a bunch of proteins that formerly weren't solved. It's like beautiful. You know, they just sort of taught you how to do something. So my question is, are there other spaces or other sort of areas in which we're using games to improve the performance of work systems and allow people to do more, you know, and become better at, you know, productive work? I mean, games are great for fun, but where else can we use them to make the world, you know, more productive?
Do you want to do it?
No,
or
I don't. I mean, yeah, people are doing that. I'm not doing that, but it's being, it's getting done. Like, yeah. Google's doing that. Image search, I guess, is a good example of that. It's not really a game, but.
But it's about distributing work amongst many, 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 many minds that can then work all together on a problem at once, or something like the protein folding problem, which is really about man hours applied and like moments of creative inspiration that come after hours and hours and hours of work. And by getting millions of people to play, you're just putting more hours on that.
And they didn't do it because they wanted to discover protein. They did it because it was fun. Right? It was a fun game. It was the visualization was pleasurable to actually play, so because of that they became experts, right, in a field they would never have become experts in otherwise. And then that empowerment allowed them to find these new proteins. I think that's a really beautiful thing. A lot of there's a lot of fields where this thinking is being applied. One of the problems is that when people come to you and they say, well, I have this thing, this problem I want to solve, right? They often don't understand the need to motivate players with the actual good game, right? So they're like, I have this problem I want to solve. I want, people to learn more about math, right? And I don't want kids to turn off from math, okay? So let's make a math game, right? Which, of course, you know, it's kind of like, when your parents used to disguise the medicine and like this yucky stuff, and you just like, I know it's in there, right? So you have this inherent problem when you have too much. There's the needs are too bald, right? They're not. They don't make a good enough game. Now, Fold is like a wonderful example of them making a great game and then it happening to also align with the research goals, right? But I think a lot of times when you go into these design problems, you're set up with these standards, you're given, you know, Common Core standards or, you know, sort of the 12th grade standards for this, that, or the other thing, right? And then you're supposed to inject those into the game somehow. And what often happens is it's a just a train wreck. frankly.
Well, it's a little what you were talking about with gamification. The first thing you have to do is inspire them to play and inspire them to be clever or creative in that problem solving that you're trying to provoke.
Game design is actually a little bit like magic. I mean, when it works, it's beautiful. And if you can, but if you see the, if you see the strings or the, you know, then it's not magic anymore.
Yeah. I thought that the notion about folded is a really interesting one, and getting away from a lot of what I thought you were talking about, which is primarily competitive games, talking about something that has a structure and people working within that structure. And folded is one dimension kind of lower than that in the sense that you're actually solving a specific problem. And then on the other side, there's a social dimension, which you kind of touched on, but I think, you know, things like Civilization or The Sims really hit at. And so what I heard you talking about was a lot about games and not so much about game theory. And so if we're moving into game theory, you know, and thinking about things like the prisoner's dilemma and how do we introduce that to people and how do we solve that as a problem or make people aware that this is a framework that they can work within, what are your thoughts about that kind of thing?
I think in the back of your mind, it's always going to taste like medicine. You know it's medicine. You know by playing this folding game, you're doing good in the world. So I think that mitigates some of the problems the design may have. Like maybe it's not a game you would pick up off the shelf at Blockbuster. Maybe you play it for a variety of reasons. And it's hard to imagine other problems like that. These are like, I feel like problems with databases, all these games, like the folding game, the mind reading game where you try to think of the same words other people think of when they look at a photo. So not all problems are like that. And I don't know.
In fact, I think a lot of the problems you're talking about, which are specifically social and psychological problems, like the prisoner's dilemma, certainly...
Well, there's a game game for that. I think DEF CON gets to that.
The idea of like, in that direction.
You know, a game about mutually assured destruction or thermonuclear war, what would happen if, you know, you're playing as one country.
But it's back to even the very first thing Tracy was talking about. You know, these are, particularly the prisoner's dilemma, but a lot of the game theory things are situations, right, in which we happen to know through psychological research that people respond in specific strange ways that seem perhaps counterintuitive or against their best interests. And if you want to provoke people to engage with those situations, you can build... Most of the games you cited are what I would call simulation games, games that simulate larger complex systems that you move in and out of, like Civilization, which he mentioned, where you are a grand poobah of a civilization, and you advance your culture and your technology and conquer land around you, and it's a simulation. It's trying to, at some level, accurately represent how that works, but so also at some level provoke accurate situations that real people might find themselves in. And I think that's where you can start to get at or attack these psychological problems or sort of pose these psychological questions to an audience.
So, I have worked on some games that try to change behavior, which is kind of the at root, if you follow your question through, what we might try to do with games, right? Is we might try to use them to allow people to test their ideas about a situation in a safe place and then hopefully come to some realization and then change their behavior in the real world. And I have, like, for example, I'm working on a suite of games called Collegeology Games where they're interventions to help kids who might not have access to counseling, college counseling, understand how they might have a path to higher education. And so, you know, that path is a very strategic path. And so, interestingly, the games are strategy games where you're learning, you know, how to manage your time, how to vocabulary things like what is a letter of recommendation and, oh, maybe I should request it ahead of time because at the last minute I won't have it in time for my application. And so these are basic strategies that kids in, you know, families where their parents have gone to college or in areas where they're getting counseling, it's great. They learn about that. But, you know, in California, we have a horrible student-to-teacher ratio, counselor-to-teacher ratio. We have 900 to 1. The you know, sort of suggested ratio, I think, is 200 to 1, and the national average, I believe, is like 450 to 1, and we're at 900 to 1. So these games are built for kids to play and kind of get that vocabulary, get that strategy, and hopefully then they incentivize them to go in the real world and try to find out the information that they need. They're being tested right now in Los Angeles schools, and we'll see so far we see that if they play them twice, the first time they are a little like, wow, this is scary. And the second time they start to have a sense of empowerment and their college-going efficacy seems to go up because they seem to take ownership in those strategies.
Hi, my name is Max. I wanted to get your thoughts on, you guys talk a lot about social gaming, and technically it's you're interfacing with a machine of some kind, which is, it could be an algorithm that you're interfacing with, and by definition that wouldn't be a social thing because you're interfacing with an algorithm, not an actual, you know, human, because algorithms are getting better. They can react. They can...
Are you talking about AI, like computers planning?
Yeah, they can analyze, you know, so these algorithms and the near future are probably going to replace actual people that you interface with. And do you think that that's going to have a negative effect on humanity's, you know, social interaction, or is it going to have a positive effect, and how do you think that's going to happen, negatively or positively?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to replace humans.
Yeah, in fact, I think what Mark talked about earlier, when he talked about being cheated out of that arcade experience, is exactly why they won't replace humans. As AI is getting better and better, and as, you're exactly right, as algorithms can do a better job of mimicking people or respond more naturally, as we get better at procedural development, which means writing code that spins off whole worlds and sort of reactions to players' input, we're still moving, as the tools get better, back towards making games where you do play with another person, where you and a buddy sit down at a joystick next to each other and play a game, where we've had an explosion in games being developed like Staccato, which some of you got a chance to play in the courtyard, which is totally non-digital. It's a new playground game. It's basically, it doesn't play like Foursquare, but it needs chalk and a bouncy ball the way you do for Foursquare, and you can pick it up and play it anywhere. And I think as the field of game design grows and as people get more and more excited about it, they're just naturally pushing away from exactly what you're asking about. I think there's a human desire for interaction that prevents us from ever relying on algorithms to provide it.
Yeah, and you miss out on the community around surrounding a game. Like if you play, I don't know, if you play golf, if you're not playing golf at the time, you can still chat with your friends about, you know, the intricacies of a course and what's the best iron to use on that. And this guy beat me with that club, but, you know, maybe there's a better way. So I think while AI could become the greatest player ever, it's hard to make an adaptive AI that also lives and breathes and exists outside of the game. You don't think so? Yeah, well, the other side of that is, yeah, once we're in the Matrix, then who knows? Yeah.
All right, so. I have one more. Just time for one more.
Hi. I'm interested in augmented reality, and more specifically when AR is more integrated into our daily lives, so not too distant future. Can you comment on how you see games may evolve, or gaming may evolve to that new augmented reality?
Yes, let me tell everyone in the room what augmented reality is, and then let Tracy and Mark answer. Maybe all of you know already, but when we say augmented reality, we're talking about is using digital tools or the digital world to augment the reality around you. The really obvious way that some of you may have done this is, if any of you have an Android phone, it's got a program on it probably called Google Goggles. When you hold it up on your screen, it shows what's coming through the camera, but it superimposes over that extra pieces of information or little maps from Google Maps or things like that. So you're looking at reality, but it's been augmented. You can make games that do this, where you're taking reality around you, and sometimes you're looking through a viewfinder or a camera, or sometimes you're doing it in other ways, where you're sort of augmenting and adding things in a digital layer on top.
and I think we're seeing other apps on your phone that, you know, are the start of this augmented reality. Games like Diplomacy, to go back to this old board game from the 60s, I can play it on my phone, I can chat with my friends, I can do all sorts of backroom deals wherever I am all the time, and I'm constantly being updated. So there's games like that already. And
yeah, you know. I mean, for me, I look at augmented reality as just another piece, another thing that I can make play out of, right? So, like, for example, we have these little, I'm not supposed to show you, but we have these little things on our ears, right? And as a person, when you put on a special, you know, earphone, or you put your special hat, you put your special glasses on, you're like, all of a sudden you're like, hey, I'm a secret agent, I'm playing a role. Augmented reality is a little bit like that. Like, I can imagine having augmented reality glasses, and I could play a game where I was like, oh, I'm trying to ID this, you know, the spy in the room, right? We could actually play with it in some interesting way. I don't actually find the technology itself by itself particularly interesting for me. I just want to make playful situations out of it, right? And so that's you know, for me, that's what's interesting.
Okay. Tracy and Mark, thank you both very much again. And
thank you.
Let's all three thank the library, which was awesome for having
us
out.
Yes, thank you for the library, yes.
Yeah, the library rocks. And if you didn't find postcards and things outside, come to IndieCade, because it's awesome. And it's
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.